Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is Redmond against Radio Shack, 14-1470. And anytime you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Curtis Warner. I represent 4 out of the 21 persons who have filed objections in this case as to the Radio Shack settlement. A settlement that provided class members a $10 coupon, a coupon that could have also been obtained had the class member simply filled out a survey that was on the Radio Shack non-FACTA compliant receipt itself.
So I have a question for you. Does the record show how many items at Radio Shack cost more than $10? There's all this talk about 6,000 things can be purchased inclusive of tax for $10.
The Gupta objectors did, to answer the question exactly, no, there's not a specific number that is in the record. There are items that are above $10 as exemplified in the Gupta objectors appendix, I think it's A28-9, that shows a Radio Shack circular available from the Radio Shack website.
And so just and I have one point of clarification. These are partially stackable. So actually, if somebody wound up with 3 coupons, they could buy a $30 item. Is that correct?
That would be correct. However,
exchange them, I should say. I don't want to say buy. Exchange them for a $30 item.
Correct. That is correct. However, there are purchases. For example, one of the objectors had purchases of over $50. Some had over $100. So it still would not be a complete item.
So even if we thought that coupons are discounts and that something that's just a piece of paper that gives you a free good isn't a coupon for CAFA purposes, would it be your position that the evidence shows that this is a mixed settlement, partly coupon, partly not coupon? I mean, you're telling me that there's some evidence that these things are used in part as coupons.
I believe that the Kasson objectors would be the better party to address those. The Gupta objectors primarily are the objectors who object that the settlement versus the strength of the case was the proper analysis.
Okay.
Although
we'll ask Mr. Frank.
that's fine.
I think he would
as
be,
well as defense counsel.
In order to divide the arguments, I think that would be the better approach, is to have Mr. Frank address those questions regarding valuation of what we deem as both coupons. The Gupta objectors raised 2 primary arguments that the opinion of the magistrate judge should be reversed. The first one is that the district court erred in assessing the settlement amount versus the strength of the case. The seminal case in judging willfulness is the Supreme Court case in Safeco. Safeco allows a defendant who has been found to have violated the act to offer a pro-offered explanation of why the act was violated. Safeco states that their reading of the statute was objectively reasonable, or if there was advice of counsel that was reasonably objectable, then the defendant, albeit wrong, cannot have willfully have violated the act. In this case, the district court judge stated that it is a question of fact. The Gupta objector stated it's a question of law. And actually, in fact, the Safeco analysis is not even applicable here, because there was no pro-offered explanation by Radio Shack.
The standard of willfulness in the law is usually thought to be about the most demanding standard, requiring that you know what you're doing is illegal. And usually an empty head is a pretty good defense to that. It might be embarrassing to say so, but why wouldn't it be sufficient as a matter of fact to just say, I didn't know?
Well, Safeco seems to have changed that analysis. Safeco looks at it more as a question of
law. Well, it has both. Under Safeco, it seems to me that there's both an objective and a subjective content to it.
I disagree, because the courts following it, 1-800-CONTACTS, this court, Shell Oil, looks at it as a as a willfulness standard is where the analysis is whether as a question of law a reading is reasonable or
well,
not.
I, thought, I don't get the difference, but I thought the proposition was that willful means unreasonable, so it's an objective standard. It's not what they think. It's just, you know, would it be unreasonable to believe that you had no problem? Isn't that
what that is correct, is that if there's a pro-offered reasonable explanation. But in this case, there's actual knowledge. They knew
so,
what the law
yeah,
was.
Yeah, but so what? So is what is unreasonable here that having, you know, having switched to another contractor to produce their receipts, they didn't check, they didn't ask the contractor, okay, let me see exactly what the receipt is going to look like. Is that the problem?
If willfulness is a factual matter, that is correct, Your Honor.
Don't understand you. I'm not talking about fact. Is it your proposition that what they should have done, which actually seems like what they should have done, since they, you know, once burned, twice shy, you think the second time, they say to the contractor, okay, before I, you know, put these receipts in all my stores, let me see what it looks like. I want to make sure that the expiration date isn't on it, right? Wouldn't
yes.
that be the reasonable thing to do?
Exactly. That would be what, if somebody was wearing a general counsel's hat for a corporation, they would do that. Knowing what the law is, they would make sure it was in compliance by simply looking at one of the receipts, not allowing it to be printed out 16 million times before they were sued, which happened in this case.
But why isn't the failure to do it could either stem from a state of mind that was indifferent to what the receipt said, maybe it's all 16 digits plus the expiration date or whatever, or the failure could stem from negligence. And if it's negligence, then how is it willful? You know, everybody agrees that they know what FACTA requires. You agree? I mean, I don't have any problem with that proposition. But I guess I'm not comfortable with the thought that once you know what FACTA requires, willfulness is proven as a matter of law. That the behavior that follows that knowledge has nothing to do with it.
There is the Sixth Circuit case law that says reckless disregard of a known law is in itself willfulness. Recklessness is willfulness.
And recklessness is different from negligence.
But this would be recklessness, where you have where you know that this is the law, this is exactly what you're supposed to be doing, but you don't do anything to ascertain whether or not your conduct is violating the law. This is a receipt.
I get it that's a great jury argument, right? That you've got knowledge of the law, failure to comply 16 million times, but we don't usually determine those kinds of issues of state of mind as a matter of law.
Well, the Supreme Court in writing Safeco actually based it off the civil rights cases is what a reasonable officer would know at the time where they were confronted with a situation. Safeco borrowed that analysis here. So the question is, would a reasonable company in the defendant's shoes engage in the same conduct? Here, the case law was very clear. This was not conduct that
That works on the objective branch, but not the subjective branch, right? I mean, in qualified immunity, we don't pay attention to subjective understanding of the law. But with willful violations of the law, we do. You want punitive damages in a civil rights case under 1983, you've got to prove a higher level of culpability. And that's always a jury issue.
Well, these are potential. Willfulness, though, has been decided by this court as a matter of law in 1-800 contacts, in Shell Oil, dismissing cases, finding no willfulness. I see my time is up.
Sure, you can save one more minute.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Frank?
Thank you. May it please the court, Theodore Frank for the Kasten, Rosman, and Scott objectors. I think this case is a straightforward application of Eubank versus Pellicorp, which 753 F3rd at 726 criticized a settlement where the aggregate value of the settlement going to the class was less than what the attorney's fees were.
So let's break this down a little bit. It seems to me one of the key parts of your argument is that the transaction costs that go along with the settlement, the cost of notice and so on, are really not properly attributed as a value to the class.
That's absolutely correct.
So I'm interested in that because it seems to me it is partly a value to the class. I mean, the class needs to know about the settlement. Maybe it should be split in half value to the settling defendant, half value to the class. But we all know that it costs some money to administer class action settlements.
And that's a social cost and a transaction cost of class settlements, but it's not a class benefit. If I get a $10 coupon, I don't value it at $37 because they spent $27 to distribute that $10 coupon.
Well, but what if you were entitled to a $10 coupon, but no one ever told you you were entitled to it, so you're actually down $10 at that point?
Well, then I have $0, but then it would also be valued at $0. The question is, what's the efficient mechanism to spend on settlement administration? And it should not be the case that class counsel is indifferent between spending money on settlement administration and spending money on the class, especially where here the recovery is potentially capped because of the money spent on settlement administration. And that's before most of that $2.25 million was spent on notice, which is a benefit to the defendant.
And to the class.
Well, we know the extent to which it's a benefit to the class by whether or not they exercise their rights under the settlement because they got notice. And that's, I think, the best way to count the benefit to the class.
So that's this pitiful little 83,500.
Well, it's also a big benefit to class counsel, isn't it?
And it's,
they have to notify get a class, right? The more they notify, the bigger the class, the more their potential recovery.
That's correct, too.
Mr. Frank, I'm wondering whether your position on this issue needs to be absolute. The transaction costs are there. They're real. They wind up benefiting everybody involved to some degree. But the idea, frankly, I'm troubled by the idea that cash payment to the administrator should be treated for fee purposes as equivalent to a dollar of cash put in the pockets of a class member. That equation is very troubling to me.
And it's troubling to us too, and it results in this sort of absurd result and the other absurd results we mentioned in our brief. For example, in this settlement, if a single coupon was issued rather than 83,000, as pathetic as that is, but if even as clearly absurd and only a single coupon was issued to Mr. Gupta and nobody else got anything, the settlement would be fair under the district court's analysis because there is still $2 million spent on administration.
So is it your position, one of the things your opponents argue is that functionally your position is what we learn from this settlement is that Radio Shack is willing to part with whatever it is, $3.25 million to get rid of this case. And that needs, however the documents structure it, you see that really as a common fund and that the plaintiffs, the actual members of the class, are entitled to a fair share of that amount of money. Is that right?
That's correct.
And has anyone approached it that way? Clearly the common fund cases do, but this is a case where the attorney's fees are cordoned off in some separate
group. The attorney's fees were cordoned off in Eubank versus Pella also. There was a separate $11 million fund that the class couldn't touch, and the court in Eubank said that was improper. The court should have modified that clause to make sure that if the fees were reduced, it would go to the class. So there, the $11 million to $8.5 million ratio was held to be too one-sided to be approved. And certainly there are other problems in Pella, but there were multiple grounds for reversal in Pella, is what the court said.
What's the theory of giving coupons instead of cash?
The theory is that it's cheaper for the defendant. If I give a $10 coupon, One, it might not be redeemed, but I might get the $10 credit for it. Two, if somebody uses it in my store and buys a $7 item, it's not crackable. So I'm only costing me $7.
Right?
There's no change. There's no $3 coupon given as change. Three, even if they come in and they buy a $30 good for $20 instead, I'm still making a profit.
Well, that's right, because if it's a $10 item, maybe it cost you $3 to put it on the shelf and the rest was your profit margin.
Right.
So you get the $10
coupons,
benefit.
In fact, are a major marketing strategy, right?
That's absolutely right.
They drive traffic. Somebody who has to come back to your store to redeem is in there and may make some impulse purchases, etc. That's
to
the benefit
right.
of the defendant.
As are coupons for
you're
a free
product. You're
saying
it's a racket.
Congress says it's a racket too. But in general, the way you maximize your attorney's fees in these sorts of settlements is you create the illusion of relief. And then you say, we've created this relief and we're entitled to big attorney's fees for it. And in this case, they exaggerated the settlement by saying we spent $2 million on administration. I mean, they should have bought a Super Bowl ad, then they would have spent $5 million on administration.
Mr. Frank, on this question of whether we're dealing with coupons or discounts or gift cards or whether Congress was paying the slightest bit of attention to the differences among those, could you address our comment in the Sinfuels case before the CAFA took effect on this question?
Certainly. In Sinfuel, what happened was a prepaid envelope was given to class members. They didn't have to claim it. Every class member said, here's a prepaid envelope, and you could use it to get some service from the defendant, DHL Express. The court in Sinfuel said, that might not be a coupon, but it's close enough to a coupon that we're going to treat it like a coupon for CAFA purposes, even though that was a pre-CAFA settlement. So even if it turns out I'm wrong on the definition of coupon and the fact that these $10 vouchers can be used to buy a $7 product, and therefore, the court's conclusion was because the $10 voucher can buy a $7 product, it's worth $10. Which I think is wrong by itself, but even if I'm just wrong on all of those coupon arguments, Sinfuel would say you still treat it like a CAFA coupon because it's the sort of in-kind relief that CAFA was concerned about.
Now, would there have been any way for the district court to have made better findings of fact? You know, here's this settlement. It's put on the table, $10 pieces of paper. Would there have been a rational way for the court to guess how many of them would have been used for $10 off an expensive item versus how many were used to just redeem it for a little pack of batteries in the store?
That's conceivable because I understand that Radio Shack regularly issues $10 coupons, though it's probably, I think, $10 off of a minimum purchase. And we can understand how many of those get used, what percentage of their transactions are used like that. Somebody could have introduced expert evidence on what the redemption rates are of coupons when class members go through the trouble of claiming them in the first place. And here only 0.5% of the class made the claim, which is typical.
But at least those people maybe really wanted the coupons. I mean,
right.
It's a little bit different
from
something in a paper.
The redemption rate's probably going to be higher than the 1% to 3% that we typically see in coupon settlements. Those coupon settlements are Ford gives a $75 coupon or a $500 coupon to every one of their truck buyers, and then only 75 of them get used. I see them in my rebuttal time. But it would be possible to have expert evidence on what the expected redemption rate would be, though that still wouldn't solve the 1712A problem that Congress actually wanted the actual redemption rate known before awarding fees.
Before you sit down, Mr. Frank, I'd appreciate it if you could talk briefly about the procedural issues under 23H and the question about the timing of these the objections and the notices. I assume you would agree it's important for the notice of the settlement to provide as much information as possible about the anticipated fee petition.
That's correct.
Do you think a second full notice to the class is required for
no,
a fee petition?
Just the motion needs to be reasonably available to the class. I mean, that's the language of H1.
Okay.
Is the motion, and the motion was not made available to the class until after the objection deadline.
Okay.
And it's easy enough to, it doesn't even have to be on the settlement website. The fact that you can get it on PACER should be sufficient.
Okay. So you don't anticipate then a second round of notice?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Did you ask for additional time after you saw the contents of this particular final thief petition?
There was not a separate request to, can we come in and do more? We made the objection. Mm-hmm. We've had other cases where we've gone in and your objection is late, we strike it, and it's within the discretion of the district court to strike objections that are after the objection deadline. You know, perhaps next time we'll mm-hmm. belt and suspenders it and everything. Here we just made the arguments at the fairness hearing rather than submitting more paper.
But the final petition had some details that you had not expected, fair to say?
That's correct. We did not expect $2 million in settlement administration costs. We did not expect them to claim that these were not coupons because there exist products that could be purchased for less than $10.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Is this Mr. Markoff?
Yes, sir. Morning. Paul Markoff for the plaintiffs in the settlement class. May it please the court. Your Honors, let me start by saying we obviously hoped in this case going into it that we would have a giant common fund cash settlement, and it didn't happen. We didn't get the best settlement available.
Why is coupons?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Why coupons? Why not cash?
Well, frankly, it comes down to what you can get the defendant to pay.
I can't hear you.
Frankly, it comes down to what you can get a defendant to pay. And in this case, they were entirely unwilling.
Well, paid $1 million in attorney's fees. Pretty generous.
Yes, that's true, Judge. And they
presumably, if you didn't have $1 million in attorney's fees, they would have paid more to the class.
I don't know that, Judge, but we asked for cash.
Well, they just care about the bottom line. They don't care how it divides between attorney's fees and coupons.
I'm not sure that's true, Judge, and it certainly
wasn't
here.
Why would a defendant care about anything but how much is this going to cost me? I don't care how the class counsel and the class divide up the money. I just want to make that total as small as possible.
Logically, that makes sense, but I can tell you in this case, that was not the case.
So Radio Shack is not logical, you're saying?
Well, what I can tell you is they're in-house counsel.
Well, give me a reason why it would be rational for a company to care about how much the class got relative to how much the class counsel got.
Their general counsel didn't want to pay the plaintiff's attorneys anything.
No.
Where it started.
Of course, they don't want to pay anything to anybody, obviously.
True.
Right?
But he had a particular...
All they care about is how much is going to cost them to settle. They don't care whether it's all attorney's fees or all recovery by class members, right? Why would they care?
Rationally, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor.
So you're saying they're irrational? Or?
Well, I only met the man once at a settlement conference.
Struck you as a little crazy or what?
Well, all I'm saying is he made it quite clear his disdain for plaintiff's attorneys, and that was it. He didn't really want to pay anything.
But the problem is this bottom line thing. There's a concept of cost to the defendant for something versus benefit to the plaintiff. And
yes.
Here the plaintiff are the class members. They're not the settlement administrator. They're not the lawyers. They're actually the class members. As I was saying, a $10, let's just call it a coupon for now, a $10 coupon isn't going to cost the defendant $10 because there's a difference between wholesale and retail prices, and that so the defendant kind of gets off a little cheap, you know, giving $10 of value to the class members. So that's already the case. But as I look at this, Radio Shack clearly made a business decision that it was willing to part with anywhere from 3.25 to 5.25 or so million dollars to resolve this litigation. And the question then becomes, you know, what kind of attorney's fee is appropriate for that sort of result if only 0.5% of the class finds it worthwhile to step up and get this relief? 83,500 people or whatever it is, something like that, is a pretty pathetic number.
Obviously,
out of 16 million?
Yes, Judge, and about 5 million got direct notice. I will say, though.
Oh, okay, so 5 million got direct notice, but suppose it's 83,000 out of 5 million. That's still a tiny percentage.
I can't speculate as to what motivates it. I had a case recently that we gave direct notice to everybody.
Doesn't it tell you that people didn't think it was a very valuable settlement?
If I may, the case I had recently, they could have claimed into up to between, depending on the number of claims, up to $262,000. That was the fund, and 4.4% claimed in on direct notice. So,
but the problem with coupons is, you know, some people may be mad at Radio Shack and they don't want to go back there. And I think Judge Hamilton makes an excellent point when he says even if you get a free item for $10, you might suddenly remember that you need a plug adapter because you're about to go to France or something. You remember other things while you're in the store. You think, gee, maybe it's time to upgrade my cell phone. So you buy a new cell phone. Radio Shack sells tons of things that are more than $10, as a brief look at their website would show. So, I mean, not everybody wants to shop in a bricks and mortar store for the kinds of things they have. And there's so many things that Congress was worried about in CAFA that this settlement matches perfectly. And there was a 6-month period, right? There was just 6 months for making your claims on the coupons?
Yes, though you could buy a gift card with it, which don't expire.
Okay,
if you turn it in, you can parlay it.
Right. Okay.
Buy a $10 gift card, and I guess that is crackable, right?
Yes.
So you can convert it from a non-crackable to a crackable $10.
Correct.
Or $10 minus the appropriate sales tax, right? So to make sure that it's exactly.
Well, once you have the $10 gift card, I suppose you can use it any way you want it. But you can wait and see. In other words, this was not a difficult case to wait and see how much value the class really got.
Why don't people get change? If they use a coupon to buy a $7 item, why don't they get $3 back?
Well, largely because it would add an even increased cost, which this court is obviously skeptical of the settlement to program the computers to allow for that.
Oh, come on. Look, what? I don't think your 880... What I see this, I don't think this settlement is worth $880,000 to the class members. There are too many gimmicks here. I think it might be worth half that. So I see this as a case where you're asking for a 200% contingency fee. You want $1 million for having created this gimmicky settlement, which probably is worth $500,000 or $600,000. And I don't see that the magistrate judge having made any effort to be realistic about what this coupon business is. It is not worth $880,000.
The value here, though, is, first of all, if you're valuing it, that is based on the presumption that it's a coupon, which obviously we
contest. We'll go there in just
a
second.
And also the presumption that every
I can't wait to ask you about
that. Yes,
But go ahead and answer Judge Posner before we get to that issue.
Sure.
Because your number assumes every single person goes in and exchanges it for some $9 item in the store that with the tax turns into $10, which seems highly unrealistic to me. But anyway,
I think as a 100% basis, I agree that that is correct. But our focus here, at least in the attorney's fees, which is at issue here, is that the valuation wasn't what the fee was based on. It was not a contingent fee. It was based on Lodestar, which can be adjusted up and down as well.
Yeah, and what on earth, how did you deserve a multiplier off of your Lodestar?
Well, I as the trial court found, it was given this court's precedent that a Lodestar is appropriate given the risk factors of no recovery.
With fee-shifting statutes, you're not supposed to award a multiplier, right, for the uncertainty, because only prevailing parties, if you win a judgment, you don't get a multiplier. Only prevailing parties can win a fee award at all. But I'm trying to understand how this frankly, pretty measly coupon settlement entitles you to a multiplier off of your lodestar, assuming lodestar is permissible.
Well, Judge, we asked for alternatives. We asked for, we can revisit this later, after, do final approval now, and we can revisit the fees later, because there will be more fees involved with the case, the administration of the case and such, and the court went in the direction of going the multiplier route.
Oh, before you sit down, though, when you, sure. You just reminded me of an important question I had. The district court order that is before us says that it is dismissing the case without prejudice. And it then says that it's going to go on and dismiss with prejudice after the settlement period is over. And I'm concerned about this without prejudice language.
The reason for that,
why
Judge,
is that a final judgment? Well, sounds like she could go back and think about it some more.
Well, it's not a matter of going about and thinking about it. It was built in as a bankruptcy protection. This case, unlike other settlements that I've ever seen, given the what we thought was the imminence of
but Radio that doesn't bankruptcy. Answer my problem with appellate jurisdiction. I'm looking at page A40, right down at the bottom of the page, and this happens to be the Rosman brief. The court hereby dismisses the lawsuits without prejudice. H, such dismissal shall automatically convert to with prejudice 6 months, blah, blah, blah. So I'm not familiar. Most class action settlements don't look like that.
You're correct, and most class action settlements don't build in the bankruptcy protections that we did here, and that's why it was
but
done that
way. But it doesn't
way.
Change so, our jurisdiction. I mean, you can protect against bankruptcy if you want, but you've got to have a final, you're done with it judgment before you can come to the Court of Appeals.
Right.
I'm not well, saying you didn't have a reason to do it that way. I'm just saying from our point of view, it doesn't sound like the district court was even finished with the case.
It was dismissed. That's
without prejudice.
Admittedly without prejudice.
Well, but the dismissal without prejudice actually makes no sense, right? Every other provision is a judgment. It's providing relief. That paragraph doesn't make any sense.
Well, it does in that it could be theoretically revisited if Radio Shack were to file bankruptcy. So
which means it's theoretically not a final judgment.
Well, it is dismissed, so I think it is final.
It's not dismissed because there's all this relief being granted.
Right.
I mean, the court is putting the force of its power
yes.
behind the settlement agreement.
Yes.
Money will change hands. Value will change hands. Not much, but some, okay?
Correct.
Right? And that's not a dismissal of a lawsuit. That's a judgment that awards relief.
This is largely based on precedent that says, of course, that the district court cannot retain jurisdiction over a settlement if it's dismissed with prejudice. So the only way you can get a district court to oversee this settlement is to have it be without prejudice or not dismissed at all.
No. You just say, here's the relief. The judgment is, I approve the settlement agreement and will enforce it. And that's what the rest of that order says.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a dismissal. And you don't need a dismissal to provide res judicata relief to the defendant because the relief that's provided is the relief that's provided, end of story, right?
Correct.
So should we just strike that paragraph? Say it doesn't make any sense?
Well, I disagree that it doesn't make any sense, but obviously you make the decisions. I think it's still dismissed. Whether it's with or without prejudice, it is dismissed in a final order.
Okay, we'll figure out what to do about that.
Actually, if we could, I'd like to just ask
please.
About the coupon issue under the statute, because I'm interested, Mr. Markoff, if there is any indication in, there's certainly not in the statutory language, in the legislative history, the Senate report on this provision for coupon settlements goes through a litany of a whole bunch of abusive settlements in Congress's view, which include both partial discounts of full product prices and full products or 100% coupons. So why should we conclude that Congress cared about whether there's a legal difference between a piece of paper that's good for 100% of the purchase price versus 99% of the purchase price?
You're right, Your Honor. The Senate report goes back and forth, and you can read it.
It uses both,
of course,
loosely.
And, yes, and poorly, frankly, in my view. But the difference is that in the general understanding of coupon, it's just a discount. The concern.
Whose general interpretation is that? Mr. Frank has submitted a bunch of uses. It's just not that specific or clear.
Well,
in general usage.
Well, what he wrote in his reply, they all required additional information from the consumer to give for further marketing purposes. But
why shouldn't we pay attention to the reason or to the function that this extra scrutiny of coupon settlements has in the statute and ask whether the thing that you've created is the sort of thing that needs that extra scrutiny? I mean, words don't define themselves. There's context, and Congress was addressing something.
Correct.
In the Class Action Fairness Act.
Correct. And Your Honor, the we should pay attention, obviously, but it has different provisions in it, in that it's got both sections A and B. And
so why would there's the A, B, and C problem. That's later.
Yep.
But why should we care? Why would Congress have cared about the difference between 100% discount and a 99% discount? So that's the line you want us to draw, right?
Yes, Judge.
So why would that be meaningful?
Well, I think it would be meaningful because it forces people to, and this court has expressed the concern with forcing to spend more money at a defendant. And this credit is not a requirement of it. The concern with CAFE in these sections is that it is based on falsely inflated coupon values, a percentage fee award.
That's part of it.
That's what the language certainly says, that it's based on its percentage if it's a coupon. We are not basing it on a percentage here. It's a lodestar award, which can be adjusted. So the value of the coupons doesn't need to come into the equation.
I have a question. The lead plaintiff is a lawyer who has some connection with you with him, or what?
Several years ago, I was a partner at the same law firm as he was. So that's the connection.
I regard that as very questionable. The lead plaintiff is supposed to be protecting the interests of the class.
Correct.
He's not supposed to be an agent of class counsel.
Correct.
And of course, we had that in the Pella case.
That's right.
Well, why shouldn't class counsel be required to go and find someone to be a lead plaintiff who is an independent, competent person, no links of friendship or partnership or anything to class counsel?
Well, we could if we wanted to go search out for clients if we knew of a claim first, but Mr. Redmond came to me, and he knows my experience in class actions historically on the defensive side.
But you're pals.
But
I don't think a lead plaintiff should be a pal of class counsel.
Well, we're former colleagues. I mean,
that makes it worse.
Well,
because as former colleagues, he's going to be thinking about class counsel and class counsel's entitlement. What he should be thinking about is how much can I get for the class, not for the class counsel.
Or he could be thinking that, I know this guy's work, so I'm going to hire him. He's done these types of cases, I'm going to go to him, and he's going to give me quality representation. And this case...
Oh, you mean this class action was his idea? And he came to you? That's not how it works. These cases are thought up by the class counsel. They then find a lead plaintiff.
Well, that's not true here. So
that's not true in this case. In this case, it was he who thought of the class action and then tries to find a lawyer to handle. Is that what you're telling me?
Correct. And in fact, I'll give you another example. We have another pending case against the city of Chicago, and my office happens to be across the street from City Hall. He went and bought a city sticker that also violated FACTA, and he came across the street and said, I have this claim. So I knew nothing about this at the City of Chicago. I don't search these people out. I don't advertise for plaintiffs when I come up with a claim. They come to me. They come to me by word of mouth. They come to me by my reputation and experience in the field. And that's what happened here. And Mr. Redmond participated quite heavily in this case and involved, actually offered a lot of insight in it and did advocate very much for the class. So he wasn't looking out for me. He takes very seriously, especially given that he is a lawyer and looking out for the class.
So you're saying the suit was his idea, not your idea?
Correct.
Okay, thanks.
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right, thank you, Mr. Markoff. We have time for Mr. Daly, right? Yeah. So, Mr. Daly?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. James R. Daly. I'm representing Radio Shack here today. Judges, I'd like to start by a little bit of context about what the violation was here. This is a technical violation. There was no actual damage, not a claim for actual damage. No one was injured. The legislative history makes clear that you can't even be injured just by giving somebody the expiration date on a credit card.
Let's just say the odds are extremely thin.
Yes.
By the time you work through the equation and decide what the additional exposure of your identity is from the four digits of the expiration
right.
date.
And accordingly, there was not even a claim for actual damages here. It's a purely statutory damages case.
No, we understand all of that, and we also understand that Radio Shack was in perilous condition at the time this was going on, but I'd like to hear your answer to the question Judge Posner asked a little while ago about why Radio Shack should care how the money that it's willing to put on the table to settle a case gets allocated among class counsel, administrative costs, actual class members, anything else.
I think that Judge Posner's observation is a correct one. I've actually made that statement in negotiations with plaintiff's counsel and class action, saying, you know, well, I got to write a check at the end of the day. That's what I care about. I think what I do care about is not getting into a situation like Pella, where you get so far out of whack that it does matter how things get divided up. And I would say here that we have 83,000 claims, which I think is actually a lot of claims.
Out of 16 well, million or
you,
5 million.
Well, but if you look at the sorts of claims that have been made out there in these kind of cases, it actually is a fairly high claim rate. But my point is that in terms of what you would care about, we actually set this thing up where we could have done $5.3 million. In other words, we had a situation where if there had been more claims, Radio Shack was prepared to pay a great deal more to the class, and it was sort of
in the form of coupons.
In the form of coupons, that's right, Your Honor.
How much cash were you willing to put out?
I think the actual cash outlay, Judge, would have been the attorney's fees plus the notice costs.
3.1.
And you were valuing the coupons as though they were actually $10.
Obviously, coupons are worth less to the defendant than they are to the consumer. But in this situation, it's $10 to the consumer.
Really.
Well,
they're not all going to use their coupons.
How much would you pay for a $10 coupon?
I've probably tried to negotiate a discount off of it,
yeah.
Judge.
Mm-hmm. You probably have
to. I mean, the transferability is the silliest part of this case, right? Because no one's going to pay $11 for a $10 coupon.
Oh, no one's going to overpay, Judge. But there are situations
you're going to pay less than $10.
And there are situations, Judge, in these cases where there are aggregators out there who advertise and bring in
and they
and
must
find,
buy these
find
things
coupons.
At a serious discount. Right. You know, the aggregators are going to pay $7 for a $10 coupon or something. Right.
That may very well be, but if you are a person who went through the trouble to put a claim in and say, I want my $10 coupon, and you did it, you can go to Radio Shack and buy as
you're
as
determined to get
6,000 things.
$10 off.
It's, and
but,
it,
you're gonna, but there have got to be 20,000 things that are more than $10.
Well, sure. But again, what's the violation here? The violation is a situation where the company made a mistake and when it rolled out a POS system to 4,500 stores.
Extraordinarily negligent of the company, at a minimum, not to take a look when they roll out the new system at a receipt or two to see, you know, give it to the general counsel, who I guess would have said, hey, you're printing the expiration date. I mean, how can this have happened?
That is a problem, and that's why we agreed to settle, and that's why we felt that a situation like this allowed us to provide a benefit to the class and guard against a risk of something going bad with a jury. I mean, the situation here is that willfulness has never been found against any defendant ever under the statute.
But if willfulness is just unreasonable, just means unreasonableness, it seems extraordinarily unreasonable not to have checked the second receipt, right? You screwed up once. You're sending this out to a zillion people. These receipts are going to be received by millions of people, and you don't bother to check what it says.
Okay. Your Honor, I think there were.
No, I wouldn't call that negligence. I'd call that some firing offense, right?
Well,
for your CEO or something.
I'm sure that there were.
You understand why it's broke.
I'm sure there were some difficult moments at the company when this was discovered. But this was 4,500 stores. It was a complicated situation. It was rolled out at different points in time. The receipt that we're talking about is the one that the consumer walks away with. So it's not one that we keep, that the company keeps in its
what
records.
What could be simpler
and it was missed,
than instructing the company that prints the receipt, leave off the expiration date, right? What could be simpler? I don't get it. I don't understand this screw-up.
I don't have a full understanding as well either, Judge. I mean, you know, you would think, we would have thought, I think the people that doing the testing and the people that were rolling it out would have thought that the system had that feature in it, and why would it not do that when it is something that's required by the statute to not be there?
But
so,
you know,
yes,
I don't
it should
understand.
Have been done.
Maybe Radio Shack is different from every store I've ever shopped in, but when I get a receipt, the kind that you have to sign for your credit card or something, a duplicate is printed out by the machine that has everything on it except my signature. And the merchant, in fact, does have an electronic as well as a physical record of what the receipt looks like. I'm doubtful that Radio Shack was lacking that information. But getting back to what we're really talking about, this settlement gives very little value to the class. The district court doesn't make findings of fact about what the value to the class members, the people whose expiration dates were erroneously printed, really is going to be. She doesn't try to break it down between how many are going to be used for full value, for partial value, how many are going to be redeemed. She doesn't even just stay proceedings for 6 months and check and see what happened, which you could with a very short timeline like this. I think the findings of fact are quite inadequate to support this.
Well, Judge, I would respectfully disagree. When I read Sinfuel and the cases that have followed it that talk about what it is that the district court is supposed to do in this situation, I feel that the magistrate judge did talk about enhanced scrutiny. She did apply it. I think she looked at it very carefully. Let's keep in mind also that no one is really challenging the $10 gift certificate. Mr. Franks's clients say that they're not challenging the aggregate amount. They're not challenging
the
$10.
They're not challenging the aggregate amount, but they are challenging whether it should have been a $20 coupon with 500,000 for the lawyers versus a $10 coupon with a million for the lawyers.
They don't actually do that, Judge. They actually say that what their beef is, that they say that the lawyers got too much.
Well, that's all relative, right? It's too much relative to the actual value of the class recovery. That's the problem. If you discount this $880,000, and if you set aside the notice costs, then it looks like a very huge ratio of attorney's fees to class benefits.
One thing I would point out in that regard, Judge, is that counsel, and I'm not in the usual position of defending plaintiff's counsel's fees, but they did, they did file a Lodestar analysis. I mean, their Lodestar is very close to it, so it took 1.25 multiplier to get to the $1 million.
Then you have to ask, why was it rational to invest that many hours in this case? But anyway, I understand they filed that analysis.
Well, I think yes, and but critically, the objectors don't challenge the Lodestar. They don't challenge what was put in. They don't even challenge
the
multiplier.
Because they don't think it's
relevant. They don't think it's relevant, and I wanted to address the coupon question. I think the dividing line, I think, is important under CAFA in the sense that the cases seem to talk about, going all the way back to Sinfuel, I think, talk about an entire purchase element.
Why would Congress have cared about that difference?
Because it's the whole sort of doing business. In my mind, there's a big difference between 10% off on your next purchase of at least $50.
How about the free water and the free golf balls? Congress picked those as examples of abusive coupon settlements. Those were 100% discounts.
But I guess what I would say is that there's nothing wrong with coupons per se.
No,
I mean,
that's right. Not the issue.
Right.
Okay? We all know there are reasons to be suspicious of coupon settlements, but there are situations where they make sense. And this may well be one of them. But for purposes of 1712, why is there a meaningful difference between a 100% discount and a 99% discount when Congress clearly was using the term much more loosely than that?
Sometimes your honors obviously studied that. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. It depends on which report you look at. But to my mind, it would make sense to do it. A lot of the cases draw this line on the entire product thing. It makes a difference. If I don't have to come out of pocket anymore, I don't have to bring my wallet, I can walk in with my $10 thing and walk out with a package of batteries. And that's different. I'm not sort of doing business with you. I am not having to come out of pocket. I am not adding
but
to
what
the
does
coffers
that have
of
to do
Radio
with
Shack.
Anything?
Sorry, Judge.
I don't get it. So what?
Well, I think that the so what I think is that when you look at what Congress was doing, what they had a problem with was forcing the consumer to do business with the wrongdoer and spend $50 to get this $10 coupon. That's different than walking in with a coupon and not your wallet and walking out with batteries. In certain circumstances, Judge, I would think that if you had a situation where you have wrongdoers, where you had defective products, where you had fraud, where you had things that the defendant did wrong that actually injured people, then forcing those same people to do business with the defendant is a different world than a situation like ours where there was no harm, no injury, no actual damages of any kind whatsoever. I see my time is up, and I'm happy.
All right. Any other questions? Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Daly.
Thank you, Judge.
I think you have about a minute, Mr. Warner. All right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Brief.
As this court has stated, Murray versus GMAC, Wall. Lawsuits like this might change the law, as the law is currently written, must not be subverted. Even though there are no actual damages in this case, Congress had repealed the act allowing a safe harbor, but then reinstated it. So the damages need to be followed. As far as the gift card option that the class members could use for their coupons for, oral arguments was the first time the class members found out about this. It wasn't in the notice. The court took issue in Pella that it needed to be stated in the notice of what they could get. Class members are completely unaware that they can cash in for gift cards. And finally, in order to get a Lodestar, if under CAFA, I think it's 1715B, there is a Lodestar plus a multiplier that is allowed, but that is only with a mixed cash and coupon. So there is a multiplier that is allowed, but you have to concede it falls under CAFA, and there also has to be a cash component, which in this case there's not.
So would you say that there's no rule in the statute if there is a piece of paper that sometimes is a 100%, I'll say, gift card, and sometimes is a coupon? Which these $10 things can be used either way, so I'm just seeing whether you think this is a mixed settlement of its own type.
They can't get cash, and therefore I would argue that it is not.
It's not
one.
Okay.
And thank you. If there's no
All
other
right.
further questions.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Frank?
Yes, Your Honor. On the appellate jurisdiction, on page 41, A41 of the record, paragraph L, there's an injunction against every class member currently in effect, so that would give the court appellate jurisdiction, even if the magistrate, as seems to be the case, didn't cross all the T's and dot all the I's. I want to correct something counsel said about the Lodestar. 1712B has a subsection 2 that says nothing in subsection B prohibits the use of a Lodestar to calculate attorney's fees, but that's for the scenario where there's an injunction.
It struck me as a very poorly drafted statute in that respect by the time I finished reading your briefs and the other briefs.
No dispute about that. I will not defend the authors.
It was quite a sausage factory.
Very much so. Having had a front row seat for it, even more so. But what was happening in the congressional debates was whenever there's a challenge to class actions, somebody stands up and says, well, what about Brown versus Board of Education? So they wrote something in that says, somebody beats Wisconsin and wins gay marriage and strikes down the anti-gay marriage law. Wisconsin can't get out of paying Lodestar by giving out a coupon for free wedding cakes.
Interesting thought, though.
Is that going to be coming our way?
You can say, I'm not counting the wedding cake coupons towards my recovery, my fee request. My fee request is based solely on 1712B, the injunctive relief. So, yes, we would say 1712A requires the redemption value to be calculated. And the court can say, I predict there will be an expected value of this. Any excess fees from the clear sailing will revert to the class or to Cypre if it's too small to distribute to the class. And I approve the settlement because the expected value of the coupons fairly compensates the class given the risks, yada, yada. But I'm holding on to jurisdiction to determine the attorney's fees, which is a collateral issue. And you come back, tell me how many coupons were redeemed, tell me what the redemption value is, and then I'll award you fees based on that. That's a perfectly legitimate way to do it. We're not saying you can never have coupons. We're just saying you have to comply with 1712, and when you don't comply with 1712, you don't have a fair settlement.
All right.
Judge Posner asked, why would Radio Shack care about the allocation? And the answer is, of course, they wouldn't, unless you write an opinion that says settling defendants have to care about the allocation, because if they don't, they're going to get reversed. They're not going to have their settlements carried the day. And that way, the settling defendant has to go into the court, go into the settlement negotiations and say, this is very nice of you to propose a settlement that's only going to cost us $2 million in fees and we don't actually have to give the class anything, but or a token of anything, but Judge Posner is going to yell at me later.
Very likely, yeah.
Or the Seventh Circuit, or hopefully other circuits down the line. I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Apparently none. Thank you.
Thank
Thanks you. To all counsel. Appreciate your input. We will take the case under advisement.